Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Simply Corey.
On today's episode, we've got a few news topics to cover. Before we jump into our happy America Day celebration, because by the time you're listening to this, the 4th of July just happened.
Go America!
Let's jump on in. Let's start with the news. Corey and I each have our own subjects to bring up this week, right? Let's go ahead and start with mine.
Typical.
Come on, man. I'm the host. I go first. Just this last week, we had yet another issue with BGP. Shocker. It turns out a small ISP in Pennsylvania was performing some route optimizations on their network. Which really comes down to they were breaking up some of their more general BGP routes into much smaller, more specific routes for their own customers. This is actually pretty common practice across ISPs. Cloudflare actually had a really good analogy for this. It was kind of like how the Kensington Palace is a much more specific address than London. That's kind of similar to what this ISP was doing, where instead of having a super route for a giant subnet, they broke it up into smaller routes to try and make it a little more efficient for getting traffic across their own networks. But this small ISP accidentally sent these route advertisements they sent it to one of their smaller customers, and then that customer accidentally forwarded on to Verizon, who accepted it. Now, mistakes happen. Verizon should have had filters in place to discard these advertisements. Unfortunately, they didn't.
Give me all the routes. I'll take them.
Means they took these small routes advertised by this tiny ISP and advertised them to the rest of the internet. And because they were more granular and more specific, they were accepted by all the other internet routers out there, which effectively forced huge amounts of internet traffic to be routed through this tiny ISP in Pennsylvania. Cloudflare actually noted, they wrote an article about a very scathing article, actually, where they just ripped Verizon to shreds for not having route filters in place. They noted they saw a 15% loss in global traffic during this incident. Basically, 15% of traffic they were expecting just vaporized because the ISP could not handle the load. Pretty crazy stuff. And really, this is just the latest in a string of BGP issues going all the way back towards the end of last year that kind of spawned our security prediction of the extreme security prediction of someone taking over the internet for hostage, right?
Yeah, but so comforting to know that the main protocol we rely on for the internet is so secure and perfect.
And that's
gotta love it.
Your sarcasm is
sarcasm?
Insane.
What are you talking about?
But you make a good point in that this protocol, BGP, relies on the trust system. Like, we trust that ISPs and major transit providers like Verizon will properly filter out incorrect routes. We allow smaller ISPs to basically generate their own routes to add efficiency for themselves, their own customers, but they're supposed to filter them and prevent them from reaching the rest of the internet backbone. And we've seen time and time again, even in just the last few months, this trust system is flawed. It does not work, and it causes pretty major issues. It brought down quite a few major sites during this little outage for Cloudflare. We've seen issues like with Google services being routed through Russia and into Africa because of another mistaken
Nigerian
route advertisement
by a small ISP.
Yep.
Yeah, but Mark, don't we have solutions? I mean, I email you sometimes with encrypted messages, and there's ways that I can be sure to trust you or a website. Why don't we do that for BGP?
Funny you mentioned that, Corey. Believe it or not, there is a fix, and it's called Resource Public Key Infrastructure. Which is basically certificates for route
certs for BGP.
Yep. It's a standard. It is slowly being adopted. It's still only in like the tens of percentages of advertisements
slowly
that sign them.
Slowly is like being kind, Mark.
The problem is route origin validation, the other side of that that actually validates these RPKI signatures, is not adopted at all. It's like in these single percentage
points. You say ROV not adopted at all, but you're kind of giving RPKI the benefit. What is the adoption of, just because one is 1% and the other I think is
15%?
Like 17,
I think, last I checked.
Oh, 17. Yes. Ooh. Like I said, slow is being nice.
Yeah, it's bad. But these are like the fixes. These can help prevent these problems. In that article Cloudflare wrote about this mistake, they pointed out that they've been pushing all internet service providers and backbone companies to adopt these standards pretty heavily, and it's just not taking off yet.
So let me think, internet standards that ISPs could adopt that would help the world, maybe like following anti-spoofing with BCP 38. That went so well, I'm sure this will too.
But yeah, exactly. That I don't know why it's taking so long. I mean, it's probably going to take another big issue.
Because they want all the routes.
Exactly. Well, I mean, they still get all the routes. It's just we prevent
the
their bad routes from reaching the rest of the internet. I cannot think of a valid excuse for why they haven't started implementing these yet, other than maybe they're running off hardware and or software that just doesn't support it yet, which, I mean, we've seen quite a lot of old
10 years ago, but right. I think my smartwatch uses certs. If my smartwatch can use certs, I think they can get routers to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I really hope they start picking up on it, because we are edging closer and closer to a major internet issue with a false or intentionally incorrect BGP advertisement. So that was my news story. Not much happiness on there. How about you, Corey? Do you have a news story you want to bring up?
Yes. I think there's a lot of partners out there. You know, WatchGuard is a company. We don't talk about it a ton on 443, but we sell through the channel. And there's a bunch of partners out there that use our products. And some of those partners are what are called MSPs, or managed service providers. So essentially, clients are outsourcing their networking and management to you. Right now, MSPs need to be on high alert. Bad guys are targeting you. We have news of, for the past few weeks, sophisticated attackers going after managed service providers and specifically leveraging you and your systems to install ransomware, specifically a threat I have trouble pronouncing, Sodinokibi, the Sodinokibi ransomware.
I thought ransomware was done. I thought we got rid of it.
No, remember we said it's now highly targeted.
Right.
It's not necessarily being sent to all your grandmas, but they'll go after certain verticals that need uptime and they'll target it. In this case, they went after, these are smart attackers. They're not going after a vertical that needs uptime. They're going after a vertical that they know has direct access into potentially tens, if not hundreds of customers' networks. So long story short, they're using you as a MSP to install ransomware on all your customers' networks using your own tools. So first, let's start with a little history before we dive into this. This actually isn't super new. In fact, last year, I think it was October 2018, part of the DHS, the National Cybersecurity and Communication Integration Center, or NCCIC, because we all need more acronyms in our life.
In that case, that is a long name, and I'm okay with the acronym.
NCCIC released a warning to MSPs talking about targeted attacks. At the time, they didn't share much information other than talking about how the target, you know, it's pretty obvious why attackers want to leverage the trust relationship many customers have with a managed service provider. And they said that PowerShell was used, but they didn't talk a lot in detail about it. But this year, February of this year, some MSPs are probably aware that there were some MSP target attacks. And in this case, they were actually using a specific vulnerability in one of the tools you use. MSPs use these tools called remote management systems, or RMMs. There's all kinds of them. Kaseya makes them, ConnectWise, Autotask, a lot of them. They're essentially central management systems that allow you to remotely manage lots of other people's desktops, networks, and infrastructure. So, you know, if you were taking care of the networking of 20 clients, you would use the RMM to basically get information from their network security appliances, their network appliances, their endpoints, send commands to them, and do a lot of stuff. In any case, a popular RMM is Kaseya VSA, and a popular professional service automation tool is ConnectWise. And there's a ConnectWise plugin for Kaseya that had a critical vulnerability that would allow an unauthenticated attacker to do SQL injection into the Kaseya RMM. And that SQL injection basically allowed the unauthenticated attacker to force you know, commands into the Kaseya database, and if you put them in the right place, essentially those commands get run on all the endpoints. And it was how they used this particular vulnerability to install, at the time, GandCrab, G-A-N-D-C-R-A-B,
GandCrab. Who names crab. These things?
I don't know.
Thanks, Kaspersky.
But the GandCrab ransomware was installed on many of these managed service providers' customers' network, and sometimes their own computers as well. So imagine you wake up coming in with your techs to take care of all your customers' networks, and lo and behold, your tool was used to install ransomware, encrypting all their data and some of yours as well.
So they're turning them from a MSP into an MRP, a managed ransomware provider?
There you go. There's a good acronym you can add to your hat. That's a perfect one. So that's some of the history. But more recently, in June 20th, a number of MSPs started warning about new attacks. There's a great Reddit post on one of the MSP subs that goes into a lot of detail. And unfortunately, we know a partner that suffered from the attack. So we've had direct access to some of the PowerShell scripts and the malware used. In this case, there's no root cause for how these bad guys are getting in. There's no like smoking gun vulnerability like the ConnectWise thing. However, these attacks seem to have some commonalities. One, RDP seems to be one of the attack vectors. You know, the users out there probably know RDP is remote desktop. It's Windows allows you to remotely manage other people's desktops. MSPs, of course, heavily leverage it for part of their servicing capability. One of the most common attacks is when you expose that publicly so that you can get to these desktops, people do brute force attacks. So one theory is brute force attacks against RDP servers. I'll also point out that listeners of the podcast probably know there was a very serious RDP flaw called Bluekeep recently. With that flaw, you can actually gain full control of an RDP server without authentication. Once you're on that server, it's pretty easy to steal credentials. So long story short, the initial attack vector isn't known, but RDP seems to be involved. What is known is whatever the initial attack vector is, they use it to get some of your privileged credentials. So if you're one of the MSP admins that's supporting your customers, if they can get your credential on one of your MSP tools, it's kind of like the end game for them, right? I mean, they can use, they don't have to have a vulnerability in ConnectWise or Kaseya. They just log into Kaseya, they log into ConnectWise control, or in this particular case, they can log into the web root management console. And all of these management tools are central tools that literally allow you to send commands to endpoints. And that's what seems to have happened once they've stolen privileged credentials. In one case, we've seen them use your stolen but legitimate credentials to log into the web root management console. And again, it's a simple thing. There's a setting where you can send commands directly to all the endpoints under management. There's a very specific PowerShell script we see being launched that grabs a secondary payload PowerShell script from another location. The secondary PowerShell script is actually using a well-known pen testing tool called PowerSploit, and it simply uses a particular function from that tool to directly inject, what was it again, Sodinokibi ransomware?
Yeah, that one.
directly into the memory of the PowerShell process running on all your endpoint clients.
So I may be jumping ahead a bit here. Is there no MFA on like this WebRoot console?
The MFA is an option.
Okay.
And by the way, MFA should be an option for your entire enterprise, from logging into your laptop in the morning to all your RMM consoles, to your VPN connections, to your RDP. So long story short, this is a pretty big attack. A number of MSPs have been affected, at least three the public knows of in this particular recent June attack. And it does really seem, as you have found, to be due to credential theft. Now, granted, there's some way they had to get to those credentials. But even without that, if you simply had MFA, you could certainly protect yourself from this. So just wanted to bring up this news story so that our partners and MSPs are aware of it. use MFA, man. I mean, we have products here at WatchGuard Authpoint that can provide MFA to everything. Things like Webroot and Kaseya actually support their own. I recommend you go for an enterprise solution so you can apply MFA to all your logins, but at the very least, if you can't deploy it in your enterprise yet, at least use the stuff built into your MSP consoles, whether they be PSAs, RMMs, or endpoint management tools. Another thing to think about is just aggressively patching publicly facing software. You know, if you're an MSP, you do specifically expose some of these remote management capabilities. So anything you are exposing should be patched and up to date. That ConnectWise plugin flaw was old from 2017. And while we don't know that they're using a vulnerability in this particular one, there is a pretty serious RDP vulnerability out there, so make sure that's patched. You should also really have some really strong access control lists on this exposure, or even better, VPN. Again, yes, you have to expose RDP and your RMM tools so that you can access them, but why not just make them accessible only via VPN? That adds an additional layer of security. You don't have to put them publicly on the internet, and you have another place you can add MFA to.
Now, you actually took off your suit jacket and put on a t-shirt and wrote an actually pretty cool analysis of this whole attack, right?
Oh, yeah. There will be a Secplicity post going into some detail. A partner shared some of the code that was used in this attack, and it is rather interesting. I mean, the one thing about these new PowerShell attacks is we have pretty advanced anti-malware services, network services primarily. And by the way, our services can catch many of these payloads. They catch both of the PowerShell variants, and they catch the actual Sodenokibi. I cannot say
that.
Sodenokibi.
One more time.
Sodenokibi.
All right.
They catch that ransomware too. But in this case, the executable didn't pass in normal ways over the network. It was kind of embedded in a PowerShell script. So even if you have more advanced malware, do realize some of these delivery techniques are a little more evasive. So anyways, hopefully will be an interesting post. If you're an MSP, these bad guys are smart. They realize gaining access to you gives them a big supply chain of many other customers. So you should be on high alert and make sure you're actually following all the best practices that I'm sure you all know.
And that way you won't become an MRP.
Yeah. MDR maybe, but not MRP.
Cool stuff. Those are some good tips. So really another shining example of why MFA is so important, so that even if they get your credentials, they don't just have the keys to your entire customer kingdom.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. And man, hopefully people start following that advice so we stop seeing it get hit.
Yeah, that would be a bad day, man. I'm glad.
Yes.
We're not waking
up. That would be a really bad day. So we are recording this episode right around the 4th of July. Happy America Day.
Yay!
All right. Corey's excitement is palpable.
I thought it was Russia Day now.
Oh, my goodness. And because it is so close to America's birthday, our producer actually had a great idea of combining one of my favorite topics, which is cryptography, and America's birthday, to talk about some codes and ciphers that were used in early America during the Revolutionary War. Now, these days, we rely on computers to solve really complex math problems that are used to cryptographically secure key exchanges and perform encryption. Back in the 1700s, though, for example, believe it or not, they did not have computers.
What?
They were still relying on slide rules for logarithmic math. I would not want to and do RSA encryption with the slide rule.
Computers are just on-off switches, right? I mean, in Minecraft, if I get enough sticks together, I could probably make a 2-bit computer.
You could, and I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but Minecraft didn't exist during the revolutionary period either.
Sticks did.
Sticks
granted,
did.
A 2-bit computer probably wouldn't help much with complex crypto.
I imagine, yeah. I imagine not. But even without computers, though, there was still a really big need for secrecy, especially in military communications. Imagine trying to send orders or updates of troop positions from New York down to Pennsylvania. You would need to make sure that if they got into the enemy's hands, they wouldn't be able to just read your message and go intercept those troops.
And by the way, you're not going back far enough with the 1700s. I mean, even the Greek leaders from 493 BC needed to find ways to share military communications.
The Caesar shift is a thing because
actually,
of that.
Yeah. Caesar shift is a good example. My favorite, which I believe comes even far before the Caesar shift. I don't know how to pronounce this dude's name. Histiaeus?
Sure.
H-I-S-T-I-A-E-U-S.
That was a clue for one of our puzzles 2 years ago.
Yeah. I never tried to say it out loud. I just typed it.
It was fine.
But that dude, there's like an anecdote about him where he would grab one of his slaves. He would shave the slave's head, not tell the slave what was going on, but like tattoo a message on the back of the slave's head, wait a few months, and then send the slave to one of his friends through maybe enemy territory or something.
That is hardcore. That's also a long time to wait to send a message, a bit more than like a tweet today.
Yeah, quite a bit more longer. I think it would take longer to decrypt that particular cipher. By the way, I think that was an early example of one of the first types of ciphers we'll probably get into if you think about it a little.
Yeah, that is
hiding something in something else or unexpected.
Great segue, Corey. One of the really popular methods for hiding an encoded message was actually a very early form of steganography, which if you're not familiar with steganography,
isn't steganography an early form of hiding a message?
Yes. The act of concealing a message within another file or message.
Is steganography. Yes, it's exactly. Not an early form of.
Right. What words are coming out of my mouth?
I don't know.
Okay.
Today you have the best word.
I do have the best words. Steganography, it actually comes in a lot of different forms these days, like hiding a string of text inside the data of a picture. You've done an example, Corey, where you hid an image of someone inside of an audio file, where if you view it in a spectrogram, you can see the image again.
Hang in there.
Really interesting. I mean, steganography is a really cool subject with a whole lot of practical and not so practical applications, but at least fun ones these days. But back in the 1700s, during the Revolutionary War, one form of steganography that was really popular was invisible ink, where they used chemical mixtures to write out a message either on the...
Dude, you're getting so fancy. Chemical mixtures... Just a little lemon water and a match.
Exactly. To write out a message on either a blank piece of paper or between the lines of another message. And then you could use other chemicals or, say, a candle, a match, to...
I guess a candle would be better.
Yeah.
You wouldn't burn your fingers while you're reading.
Exactly. Heat it up, and then you could view the message. I saw an example of, like, there was a few instances where they would send a citizen, because they would always try and they wouldn't use military personnel because they're spies, send a citizen into town with a shopping list, and they'd come back with like reams of paper. And hidden in that ream of paper was one particular piece of paper that had a hidden message in it.
I assume the citizen didn't even know what he was doing other than bringing paper back.
Probably not.
Kind of like the slave with his deus.
Did they not have mirrors back in that day? Like, pull it up over your head and figure out.
Did they have mirrors in 493 BC?
Listeners, probably. When was the mirror invented?
Someone had to polish up a pyramid stone enough to see themselves.
Pyramid stone, yes. History lessons from Corey Knockreiner.
Mirrors made out of polished
pyramid stones. There's other examples of steganography through the years, though. You have any you want to bring up, Corey?
Yeah. There's a very cool one in World War One. You brought it to my attention. I had no clue. But there are spies in the Belgian resistance that looked like they were just knitting yarn, but apparently they were knitting messages in that yarn string. Essentially, they would just, as they were knitting, they'd have knots at certain distances between each other, and the amount of distance actually represented a letter.
So it was, they could write the letters of the alphabet an inch apart, like on a door frame, and then you would hold your knots up on your yarn to the door frame, and it would mark out what letter it was, and you keep going like that, and you can have a whole message in it. And then they would sew that into like people's jackets or whatever people wore back in the time, and you could pull it out and have your message there.
That I would not find that if I was checking you at a checkpoint.
There was a point in time, I think it was during World War II, where like this style of stuff became so popular that some countries that were participating in the war banned people from posting knitting templates in like newspapers and stuff because they were afraid that they would contain hidden messages in them.
Always strikes me as stupid. It's the same with crypto applications and ciphers today. They ban one, but that's dumb because
there's others.
Just one of a million different ways you could use string to hide messages or books or...
Interesting. During World War II, there's other examples. There were actually Japanese spies both in New York and here in Seattle that were masking information about U.S. naval movements in fake doll orders. So they would say something like, the German bisque doll dressed in a hula skirt sent to Seattle for repairs to be completed around the first week of February, which really meant there was a damaged U.S. ship from Pearl Harbor that was in the Puget Sound for repairs, and it would be done around the first week of February. Interesting stuff of hiding a cool coded message.
I think we've all seen the movies where some spy calls headquarters and says what seems like random words, but clearly he's sharing details about the situation he's in. So imagine that. It's the same type of thing.
Yep. Even outside steganography, there were even ciphers that some of the patriots, I guess you would call them, were using during the time.
Considering how good I am at history, Mark, why don't you teach me about what a cipher actually is?
Sure, Corey. A cipher is a way to encode a message that someone in the middle, without knowing either the key or the algorithm, cannot decode that message, but the recipient can. And they're actually really popular. There was an organization known as the Culper Ring that was actually set up under orders from General Washington in New York City that would help provide information about British troop movements and surprise attacks out of New York down to George Washington. And they developed this code book, which you can actually, there's copies of it. I can't remember which museum. I probably should remember that. It's pretty cool, where they actually had translations from 763 different words to just numbers, where like 219 is gun or 711 is General Washington. It's like the sentence, one if by land, two if by sea, would be E-281-50-347, F-281-50-588. And they actually had substitution ciphers in there too for encoding words that didn't exist in the book. Now, there's actually weaknesses in substitution ciphers. Corey, you want to go over that?
Well, statistical analysis can help. I mean, if you know the language message is in, there's certain statistics about how often there's, say, a two-letter word versus a five-letter word and vowels versus consonants. So using some tricks, you can kind of sometimes rebuild messages using that sort of statistical analysis.
Yep, like the letter E, for example, is the most common letter in the English language. I think it's like 17% in general of word letters are the letter E in a message. So if you find something that's the highest percentage letter in a message, you can assume that that translates to E. This is assuming you're using a very simple substitution cipher where one letter maps to another letter.
Cool.
There's other versions of substitution ciphers like Visioneer, where each time a letter is substituted, it's substituted with a different one, which kind of breaks statistical analysis.
I mean, you could probably still use it, but then you have to start adding extra maths
exactly.
to it.
And no one likes extra math.
Sounds like George Washington was pretty smart. I didn't realize he used ciphers. I kind of thought he was into steganography, you know, the wooden teeth. I'm sure there's messages in those wooden teeth.
Probably, yeah. I mean, there are examples of other ways of hiding messages physically where they'd like hollow out a button on their shirt or hollow out like a lead shot from a rifle or even one of their writing quills and hide a message in there.
I think that's why I always was spitting out a wooden tooth. Got to pull out the little tiny scroll and give it to, I don't know, his general.
As he's polishing the pyramid stones?
Yep.
More history lessons from Corey Knockreiner. The Americans weren't the only ones during the Revolutionary War, though, that were using ciphers and encoding methods. The British had their own tricks, too. Sir Henry Clinton, who was the commander of the British forces in America, used to write hidden messages within a full letter that were only revealed if you used a mask. And this mask is called a Cardan Grill, which is named after the Italian Giarlame Cardano, who actually created it. Yeah, whatever. Close enough. But long story short, how this works is you write out a hidden message within the cutout of an image. So Sir Henry Clinton really liked the shape of an hourglass is what most of his examples are in the museums, where you'd write
it's
out your message.
It's kind of a horrible tell, though.
It is, yes.
Knows you like hourglasses. There goes your whole
Didn't
cipher.
Say they were good ciphers. He'd write out the hidden message in this shape in the cutout of a page and then fill out the rest of the page with other words that made it look like a completely different message until you put that cutout on top of it, highlighting just specific words that would be the actual encoded message.
It's just what you think, like a piece of cardboard with cutouts in certain places.
Yeah,
we all probably used them at some point. I remember old copy protection mechanisms, which literally had lots of words on a circle and a circular card and grill where you had to pick a word, turn the thing, and read the other words there too.
Where do you plug it into your computer?
This was back in the floppy days, and by floppy I mean 5 1/4. And I think Sierra used that type of copy protection on early floppy games.
You were not born. I do still have a computer with a 3.5-inch floppy drive, and I think it's like one of the Doom games, I can't remember which one, that's still on all those discs just for nostalgia's sake. I really should stop carrying that around to all my apartments. But as you can see, like, ciphers were pretty common. Corey's showing me the code wheel. Yeah, that is very similar. What is that? Like, what are they even trying to encode?
If you can't see, it's shapes, but there's some that were literally words. I just picked the first one I saw.
Interesting. So there were ciphers used during the Revolutionary War, and this trend has carried over through just about every single war since inception, because there's always been a need for hiding these messages. Now, you've probably heard of the...
Copy protecting your
software. You've probably heard of the code talkers back during World War II, where we used Native Americans with a language that most people could not understand or even speak, and they were able to send encoded messages between troops. Really interesting stuff. Thank you, Wes, our producer, for bringing this to our attention, because on America Day, we like to celebrate our achievements.
Or British achievements or Greek people's achievements.
Well, we pointed out the British achievements weren't too great in this one. It's an hourglass. Anyone can find that out.
Yeah. Those silly Brits.
No,
they
obviously
certainly didn't help crack an enigma or anything.
No, of course not. Thank you, Mr. Turing, for saving the world. It would be actually really interesting. We should do a future episode where we talk about some more of the more complex
things. Is there a British Independence Day? Oh, yeah. They were the ones that had everyone subjugated. Oops. Sorry, Brits. If you couldn't tell, I do love you based on my Turing comments. But maybe we find their day and talk about other cryptography then.
Speaking of which, I still want to get my hands on an Enigma machine. Once I become rich, that's going to be one of my goals.
Isn't there like 13 of them or something? There's not many left.
I know.
You have to go. You can break into the NSA and grab the one they bring to all the shows.
Or Mitnick's house. I know he has one.
He has one?
Yeah, that's, of course he does. He's King Hacker, right?
He's been in jail a long time. That's doubly impressive.
Yeah. I would love to have. Who was it? It was the NSA brought one to RSA, not this year, but last year.
They bring it a lot. Although I bet you it's just a copy. A duplicate.
I would take it. They are still such cool machines. So maybe a topic for a future podcast.
And you're with that, explain everyone in audio how the gears in the machine work.
Now, if you can't see, I'm setting rotary D to 37. And another time. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics, suggestions for your future episode topics, or if you know when the mirror was invented, tweet out at us. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey's at @SecAdept. The both of us are at #The443Podcast or #PolishedPyramidStones. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.